Hello everybody, we are very pleased for this first morning talk to welcome Deepak Ugani. Deepak Ugani is a co-director of Biofuel Watch, and he has also consulted to a wide range of organizations, including the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the Home Office, Citibank and Vodafone. He has moved several policy motions at the Green Party and contributed to radio and TV news programs on the impact of biofuels. Today he's going to talk for about 25 minutes, followed by 20 minutes of question and answers.
Well, thank you everyone. Thanks for coming and joining me. It seems like a bit of an exodus after the plenary session. I thought, well, what is it about biofuels that frightens people or concerns people? I was also given the wrong impression on the timing. I thought we had 3/4 hour, and we've got about 20 minutes. So I'm going to have to truncate everything and rely on your questions to sort of bring out some of the areas that I'm most useful to you. I work with a team of three others in this small, tiny NGO, self-funded NGO called Biofuel Watch, and we really put it together about a year and a half ago after an event called Climate Camp at the Drax Power Station. I know one or two of you were there at that event. And it was a result of our serious concerns about the rapidly growing nature of biofuels grown on agricultural land with agrobiofuels or agrofuels, and the obvious corollary of that, which is that it's going to involve a lot of deforestation, a lot of land use change in terms of grasslands being turned into agricultural plantations. And we already knew that industrial agriculture is one of the quickest ways to speed up climate change, not only just because of the fossil fuel intensivity of the chemicals used in agriculture, but also because of the vast amounts of carbon that lie in intact soils that haven't been disturbed since the last ice age. As soon as you start flying them up, carbon dioxide gets released in large volumes. And of course, if you're diluting it, removing the biomass from the surface, of course, there's a massive greater addition. Since then, we found out a whole host of other concerns that make biofuels right at the epicenter of climate change. Now, I'd like to begin this by just saying that there are two drivers of climate change, and most of the world speak about just one. At a conference in London, in which James Hansen was speaking from the NASA Goddard Institute, ecosystems barely got a mention. But what gets very heavy billing is emissions, quite understandably. CO2 emissions and the other greenhouse gas emissions. And that, if you like, is one of the pillars of climate change. If we exceed emission thresholds, we cross what are called tipping points, and the potential to stabilise climate is lost. The other way of triggering catastrophic climate change is through the loss of ecosystems. So that's the second pillar. We've got emissions and we've got ecosystems. Ecosystems hold the climate together. They drive the biospheric cycles, like the carbon cycle, the oxygen cycle, the rainfall cycle. Strip the planet of ecosystems, and even if you bring emissions right down to back to pre-industrial levels, something like 280 parts per million, you still don't have a stable climate, because all those cycles collapse. So it's ridiculous that as a global, informed scientific body, the IPCC spends most of their energy talking about emissions, and doing that professionally. I mean, emissions have done nothing but rise since 1997, and inexorably since the year 2000. And ecosystems is almost not addressed at all. So our aim in terms of Biofuel Watch is to challenge the area around biofuels in a sort of appropriate campaigning way, because it brings ecosystems onto the horizon. But you could put into the pot industrial agriculture, plantation forestry, bioenergy, not just biofuels, but bioenergy in the form of biomass. Any of those could trigger catastrophic climate change by loss of ecosystem. So I want to share a little bit about what that entails over the next 15-20 minutes. I'm going to miss out some of the slides here, excuse me doing that, just because I need to keep it short. You've probably all seen this. It's Mike Mann's famous hockey stick curve, slightly changed to get out of copyright inversion in particular. And what you'll see on the baseline there is this oscillation between 180 and 290 parts per million of CO2 on the left-hand side, and that's the blue varying line. And what it's also implying is that we go from warmer periods, which is the 280 point, I can't point you to the top of the peaks of the of the blue line, to the troughs, which are the ice ages, which is about 180 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. And we seem to oscillate between those peaks and troughs in a rhythmic way. Well, it's always got some periodicity to it, about every 100,000 years or so, linked to the Milankovitch wobble in the Earth, but also to other things as well. Now, one of the areas that we might look at is recognising that actually the oscillation between ice ages at the bottom, the prolonged periods of cold, and the peaks, which are very short periods of interglacial, of which we're at the end of one now, is actually a normal envelope in which for us to live. So the area of the blue is the area in which the human race has evolved. We've been here for about 500 million years in our, you know, since we split from our common ancestor as Homo sapiens. And our genealogy is completely related to being within that envelope. Now, what scares climate scientists is the trajectory of warming that is occurring as a result of the greenhouse gas emissions and particularly CO2 concentrations on the left-hand side. And when they compare this to other very sharp rises in CO2, the only useful comparisons they make are to other periods of historic mass extinction. Particularly the last mass extinction 55 million years ago, the one with the Precambrian, is it? The 251 million years ago? End permanent extinction period. So, that's the frightening thing, that with this vertical trajectory, there seems like there's no way to actually stop it. So I want to talk a bit about, towards the end, and I hope some of your questions will be about, you know, what can we do, given the pretty awful position and the awful prognosis that seems to befall us. The Arctic has shrunk, we know that. You've got the red line there of the 1979 figures, this is from NASA, and in 2003, that's the white area there, shows you how much the Arctic ice has actually shrunk. Now, since then, between 2003 and 2008, it's reduced massively more. The figures for 3 years ago were roughly a loss of 100,000 square kilometres of Arctic ice a year. It's now gone up to 1 million square kilometres of Arctic ice a year. So we've shot up tenfold in just the last 3 years. Now what that tells us is the linear degradation of the Arctic has now been exponential. And that in our terms, the UNME means it's cost of sticking quality. It means that it's only melting. It's encouraging firmament. And there's nothing we can do to restore the Arctic. Now scientists are clearly very worried about tipping points because it means the whole game changes under that circumstance. It means that the external intervention of human reduction in greenhouse gases starts to become much less effective. Now that's just one tipping point. There are something like 8 to 10 other tipping points, and within them there are something like 50 to 70 feedbacks. In other words, ways in which the tipping point can be accelerated or decelerated. A positive feedback which would accelerate climate change would be a positive feedback, and one that would decelerate climate change would be a negative feedback. So we really want the negative feedbacks. The trouble is, out of that 60, 70 feedbacks, almost all of them are positive. There are just maybe 2 or 3 negatives, and they have no real substance compared to the gravity of the positives. Now, if that seems alarming, it should be, but that doesn't mean to say it's game over. There's areas we can talk about. I don't want to go into too much detail on this, but this is a Siberian permafrost, and you can see that as it starts to melt, the permafrost, as its name implies, should be intact for 365. You start to see photosynthetic activity of lichens and mosses on that land, and what that tells us is that methane is being given off. Methane is something like 23 times as powerful as CO2 as a greenhouse gas, so that's important stuff to us if methane is belching out of the Siberian permafrost. That is a potential tipping point. We haven't reached a tipping point yet where it's started to go exponential, but at some point there's logic would tell us that soon enough we will. And if we do, there are other tipping points behind it. Soon after that you've got the Alaskan permafrost, you've got the Scandinavian permafrost. So there's other permafrosts, all of which contain vast volumes of methane. The other one I want to tell you is the Greenland ice sheet. There's other bits and pieces there. There's also the oceanic systems. The only reason I want to talk about two is because we've crossed the Arctic, so I want to mention that. The Siberian permafrost is the one that we're most likely to cross
And that's what I would have said probably a couple of years ago,
until a new advent appeared on the stage. And now there are two tipping points competing for second position. One is a Siberian belching of methane, and the other is a potential collapse of the Amazon rainforest. And this is really the area that brought that drove biofuel watch to really come together and focus on this issue. The Amazon rainforest is completely unique compared to all the other ecosystems. Now, all ecosystems absorb carbon, they all drive the biospheric cycles that I talked about earlier, and therefore they're all critical. You cannot say that we can do without the carbon in the forest, but we can't do without the Amazon. We actually need both. But the Amazon is unique in as much as it drives the rainfall cycle by a Hadley cell, irrigating large parts of North America and most of South America. 50% of the rainfall in Argentina comes from the Amazon rainforest. The American grain belt, the US grain belt, gets its rains primarily from the Amazon. The Amazon is not there. The US is no longer a grain exporting country, and similarly for South America. Now, why should I be concerned, given how large the Amazon is? I'm 4,000 kilometres from east to west coast. This is a vast stretch of forest. Well, the problem is, like any natural system, highly complex integrated system, it has its own stability. We call it homeostasis. And that stability can easily be imbalanced. And if it is imbalanced, it's again like the Arctic feeding on itself. It starts to propel its own demise. It no longer requires external agent of humankind to destroy it. It will destroy itself. And it does it by internal feedbacks of literally drying out. So what happens is you cut large areas of the forest, thousands of square kilometres, and turn them into monoculture plantations. The land dries out, and the rains are not able to recycle. What happens is with the Amazon, the rains fall generally on the Atlantic side, and they recycle westwards across the rainforest. The same rain irrigating the entire 4,000 kilometres. If the rains fail, then the forest west of where they fail ends up in drought. Now, we've had 3 years of drought, which has been unheard of in the history of the Amazon. But there are occasional drought years, and El Niño year is classically a drought year, and every sort of 600 to 800 years, there is a major drought in the Amazon, and there are forest fires and so on. We're having them now almost every year. 2005 was a major drought year. 2006 was a light drought with some rain return, but it's still drought. 2007 we saw a significant drought, not as bad as El Niño year. So we had 3 years of drought, and therefore now the Amazon is in some areas is tinderbox dry. So why are we cutting the Amazon back so relentlessly? Well, there are two drivers for biofuel expansion. And I'm picking the Amazon because it's the focal point, but this is happening all over the world. Southeast Asia, particularly Indonesia and Malaysia, there's massive deforestation, peat forests there, all of which are integral to stabilising climate. The two converging imperatives are, I'm going to take the second bullet point first, because I think that's probably the most focal one. It's a concern about people. I hope my figures are right. We use about 86 million barrels of oil per day globally. Out of that, light crude is about 72 million barrels. I'm sure Steve will correct me if I got that wrong. Early 70s. And so we're at least 10 to 12 million barrels short. And what they're trying to do is plug that gap by using new fuels like biofuels, and also liquefaction of tar sands, oil shales, but actually finding alternative sources to bridge that gap. And also the much heavier oils, which are harder to extract and much more energy intensive to refine. Logic would tell you that maybe we should adjust our economy, maybe we should try to do things differently, but of course the aim is really just to plug that gap. So when the government says that this is a climate mitigation measure, agri-fuels, you need to take that with a pinch of salt. It's also a way of propelling and promoting the economy to keep business as usual. The idea of climate change, I've
you know, you've got a very clear idea of that already. The Kyoto Protocol came in 1997, and by 2010 we need to now see the next phase of it. And during that time, emissions have gone through the roof. There has been no mechanism within it that's allowed us to stabilise emissions there, and that leaves us in a very worrying situation. And the worrying situation is that the drive for economic growth and profit is overriding the logical sense that we should start to be reining back and hold that protocol central to what we do. On the biofuel side of things, there are many people worried about oil shales and tar sands because of the intense carbon emissions and energy intensity of getting them out, and also the amount of carbon emissions associated. But with biofuels, there's the additional problem of ecosystem loss. Now, bioethanol and biodiesel are the common ones we see already in the forecourts of fuel stations. Biobutanol is what they're working on, a different form of biofuel. I'm told that it has a very strong likelihood of being able to be used as a kerosene replacement for aviation. And indeed, Richard Branson, I think on the 24th of this month, is test flying the Virgin plane, running one of the engines on 20% biofuel, which would be biobutanol. The wedges, there are 14 wedges which the IPCC say are ways, an effective way of bringing emissions down by 2050. And one of those wedges is biofuels, which would end up producing something like 24 million barrels of biofuels per day. Now, the challenge with that is that the land required to do that is about 250 million hectares, or about the land mass of India. But it couldn't be India because you need very high productive land. So it would have to be from all over the world. And that's just to keep emissions stable. That's just to deal with the growth in emissions and to bring down... if I just show you the picture here. This is slightly out now, a couple of years out, but you can see where the 2005 figure is at about 7 gigatons of carbon emissions per year. And we need to... We actually need to bring that down to something like half. If I just explain the rationale for that to you. Ecosystems, mainly the oceanic environment and the terrestrial environment, absorb about 50% of all the emissions we produce. And the remaining 50% goes out into the atmosphere and adds to warming. So logic tells you that if you don't want to add to atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases, you need to bring that down to at least 50%, because the ecosystems are currently absorbing 50%. So that's the real aim, that's the logic behind our thinking. Now, what the government's aiming to do, or what the United Nations are aiming to do, is to bring emissions down to the same level as they were in 2005, in other words, about 7 gigatons of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions per year. Well, that's already causing, you know, very significant problems. So just bringing it down to that level by 2050 or 2055 is not going to be sufficient. And one of those wedges is the biobutanol, the biofuels. This shows you just how fast the growth in biofuels is occurring. Bioethanol has had a significant head start, mainly in Brazil, and so that's why the curve has been peaking from the mid-80s, but from being rising high from the mid-80s, whereas biodiesel has just been starting to rise reasonably high since the mid to late 90s. And this is the projections of where they'll be in the US and the EU over the next 10 to 20 years, 10 years or so, 10, 12 years. Just to contrast what we're doing, in the developed world, we're promoting biofuels as being the solution, and some car manufacturers actually aim to sell more vehicles on the back of being supposedly green. And at the very same time, in another part of the world, in Mexico, this was last January 2007, 75,000 people protested on the streets complaining of the price of corn flour, as their basic staple had basically doubled in price and has gone up in price since then. And essentially many people who spend 70% of their income on just their food alone don't have the extra surplus in which to buy and purchase when prices double. This shows you the sorts of maps that corporations are starting to use as they divide up large tracts of the world and say this is the land that we can use and is available for biofuels.
the mentality is that because the northern hemisphere, Europe, and has trashed our temperate rains, our temperate forests for agriculture, that actually we can apply the same principles to the rest of the world. I was speaking to Amazonian scientist Peter Barniano a few weeks ago, and postulating to him that what if the Industrial Revolution happened in the equatorial region? And he said, well, we need to get to talk about this. And what he meant by that is that if we lost the rhythm of a rainforest ecosystem around the planet 100 years ago, it would have thrown the whole side of the filter. It's the more central aspect of ecosystem stability, much more so than the temperate forests, although the boreal forests are critical too. Some of the human abuses that we're seeing in the developing world around biofuels, people are, in order to take the land and convert it for use for agrofuels, people need to be removed from that land. And if they refuse to go, what happens is the planes spraying pesticides and herbicides in surrounding land will quite simply spray their land as well, primarily to destroy the crop. But if people happen to be working in the fields, they get sprayed too. And this is a little child who's on her mother's back. From a friend of ours in Paraguay, been sprayed with herbicide. This is quite typical of the encampments, the makeshift encampments that people are living in. And when they still won't go, ways are found to ensure that there's nothing for them to stay for. Well, I don't want to go too much into the human rights issue is a major concern, because we're seeing millions of people being lost, being removed from their forest homes, and basically being turned into migrants as a result of biofuels. The corporations just coming in and seizing the land. We call them land grabs. These are the sorts of areas where biofuels grow best, and clearly you can see it's the equatorial zones. And the source, the nations that are the drivers of these, you can see, are the developed world nations and China. And the EU, you can just see there how many arrows go to the EU. We are driving the expansion of biofuels in every continent through our legislation. I won't go through this in too much detail. This just contrasts the changes in landscape that people are reporting and sending back. This is Kalimantan on the left, where they say the skies never seem to clear of smoke because of the sheer level of burning that goes on there. And on the right-hand side, this chap remembered being in Argentina, went away and came back 3 or 4 years later, and the whole place had been decimated for soya. Southeast Asia's peatlands are particularly interesting because they really are major repositories for carbon. They have been intact since the last ice age, and some people even regard them, loosely speaking, colloquially speaking, as being the thermostats of the planet. In other words, whenever the carbon dioxide quantities have gone up, the peatlands absorb the carbon and deposited it underground, keeping it and storing it safe. And as long as the land remains flooded, that carbon remains intact. So these are not only incredibly rich ecosystems, but they're major and critically important repositories. And what we're doing with them is, I'll just move it on, is we're draining this land very quickly. Vast drainage channels to remove the water as quickly as possible. And from what I've just told you, you can quickly realise that dry peatland is of no use from a climate point of view. Carbon quite simply evaporates out, oxidises out, I should say. And what you would see over time is actually the level of the peat going down. They may be in some areas 20 metres deep, and as soon as it's drained, it starts oxidising. So to say that you can grow palm oil, for example, on drained peatland, and it's okay because the forest's already gone, so there's nothing you can do, you might as well grow palm oil on it, is the most ridiculous position to take. But that's the UK position on it under the new transport fuel obligation, what's called the RTFO, which is starting to comes into force on the 15th of April, and allows us to use palm oil from drained peatland. It cautions against new peatland, but is quite happy to leave that peatland drained. Now, this is a benefit to corporations because obviously there's a cash crop in terms of the timber that's removed. So there's a big benefit in using virgin territory. This is a satellite photograph of the fires in Borneo, and you can see just the spread of that. And the new palm, oil palm plants going in there. See the just very small at this point in time, and the land still being drained. Okay, back to the Amazon again now. The destruction of the Amazon is very closely linked to soya. Soya is a very useful product, not only is it available for food and for pulping, for liquids, but it's also, of course, very useful for biofuel. And what we're starting to notice now is as the price of soya goes up, the amount of deforestation increases in the Amazon, and this has already been linked to NASA did a study directly correlating the price, the international price of soya on the market to the rate of deforestation in the Amazon. This was the drought in 2005, and you can just see the lake there teeming with fish, but of course in this case dead because of the drought, the severe drought of that year, where vast areas of the forest were claimed on top of the plantation destruction. This is a satellite map from September 2007, so just a few months ago. And this is the third year of drought, as I was saying. And the satellite photograph picked up, on one September day, they picked up 70,000 discrete forest fires in the Amazon. And this shows the stretch. I've just taken the southern end of, that's the southern end of Brazil there, right down as far as the northern Argentina. And you can see just Bolivia, Paraguay, lighted with vast forest fires. And they're worse, of course, because it's the third year of drought, and the amount of plantations now are greater as well. So there's more drying of the land. We were just looking at maps for what the prognosis would be. The time of recovery for the Amazon is usually the very end period of the year, November, December, when the dry season's over, and you should be seeing the rains returning. Well, what we should be seeing in the Brazilian area is either the light green, where it says about 100 to 125, or the yellow, which is the 75 to 100. So all the light green and yellow are probably about average. That's normal rainfall. The worrying areas clearly are the browns, where you're getting below 50% and even 50 to 100% less rain. And that's the whole eastern region. And remember what I said about recycling the rains. The trade winds come off the Atlantic, they irrigate the east side of the coast, and then they get recycled in a series of hops from east to west. If they fall on the east side, which they're not doing clearly, they don't get recycled over. So it loses that flow of rain. Now that's a worry. At the time when it should be wet, for 2008 now, when it should have been getting its rain, it's not. And we'll keep looking at the data on this and see what happens. But, you know, the prognosis is not good for 2008. And that therein lies the worry, because you could have fires now spreading out of control in a fourth year of fire where the forest has become like a tinderbox. Who's driving Europe's agri-fuel policy? Well, a committee was appointed by the European Commission in 2005 to start to look at all the issues around policy development within the agri-fuel industry. And just look at the people who are being asked to be part of that committee. You know, how many university institutions are there? How many NGOs are there? Any representations from some civil society groups whose land will actually be taking for the agri-fuels? All these critical parties that could act in a balancing way are absent. So it's no surprise we stormed ahead with legislation without any kind of way of keeping it in check. And these are the companies, I'm sure many of you who are involved in campaigning and activism, many of these are very familiar to you. The legislation that we've been driving, the renewable transport fuel obligation in this country, the RTFO, is part of overall legislation to do with the EU. This is the Biofuels Directive, which calls for 10% of biofuels by 2020, 5.75% by 2010, in other words, within 2 years. Now, at the moment in the UK, we are about 0.7 to 0.9% use of biofuels in our fuel. So to get to even 5.75% by 2010, we're looking at a 5 to 6-fold, 7-fold maybe increase in biofuels in the UK. So this is a vast increase, and already we're seeing the mayhem around the world as a result of the usage that we're, you know, the small uses we have. It's much further on in the UK, in the EU, perhaps about just under 2%. One of the things that's put forward as a way of mitigating the ill effects of biofuels is to talk about what's called good biofuels, biofuels that don't destroy the environment. Well, there are some good biofuels. They're in the form of recycled vegetable oils, particularly chip panel. If it's a waste product, it can be burnt off and thrown into landfill, and clearly using it in your vehicle instead of burning petroleum is a good idea. So we would endorse recycled chip panel and the like. Some forward steps are being made in algae, in large photobioreactors. And algae have some potential too, so long as we don't start using second generation genetically modification and ways of breaking it down, like microbial, like genetically modified microbes, then they have some potential there. But that's about it. When you start looking at almost every other type of biofuel, even if you're talking about sugar cane from Brazil, you're talking about some of the ones that I mentioned, like rapeseed oil from the UK, they all have been knock-on effects, and it's deleterious to both supply and to the ecosystem. And if you want to talk about temperate biofuels, feedstocks for biofuels from Europe, then please raise a question about that afterwards. I'm talking about things like rapeseed oil and sugar beet. What the government and the EU are saying is that what we can do is create, say, sustainability guarantees. The difficulty is that all the life cycle assessments for carbon for producing each of these feedstocks for biofuels, like soy or like palm oil, is that they don't include the what's called displacement. Either the displacement of agriculture into forests, which means that new forests are cut down if agricultural land is taken for biofuels. Nor does it involve the displacement of peoples. So good people are pushed off their land, where do they go? Well, if you're a farmer, generally speaking, you'll try to find land elsewhere. And that could involve new ecosystems as well. Right, I'm going to move forward on this just to sort of try and honour the timeline that we've got. Jean Ziegler is the rapporteur, the UN rapporteur on food, and he described biofuels this summer as a crime against humanity. And what he was really talking about is the food price rises, which are causing many people to be pushed into food poverty. At the moment, something like 854 million people go hungry every year, with less nutrition than they need to live healthy. And we're pushing that figure very close to the billion mark as a result of that. He puts a figure of something like, I don't know if it's up there, but something like 60 million people more put into food poverty for every 1% rise in basic food standards. So when food goes up in price by 1%, around 60 million people go into food poverty. These are vast increases, and we've seen in some food staples increases of 50%, 70% within a single year. George Monbiot was one of the first people to call for a moratorium on biofuels, and he's called for a 5-year freeze. Friends of the Earth, Paraguay and Argentina are calling for a moratorium. Last year, the very end of the year, African NGOs came together calling for a moratorium. At the very end in December, the US came out with a number of NGOs calling for a moratorium. We in Biofuel Watch, with a number of other NGOs in Europe, have been calling for a moratorium since last summer. So there are many parts of the world that are calling, and collectively we're talking about many hundreds of NGOs have been signing these moratorium calls. Sometimes people talk about second generation. What I've been talking to you about is first generation biology, which is a straightforward cultivation of arable land or biofuels for use in vehicles. Second generation is where you start adjusting the genotype of plants in order to become more productive in their fruiting body, seed pods, more creating and more likely genetically modified microbes. So the microbial decay of plant material can happen like that. Now, if it happens like that, instead of taking, let's say, several months for the plant tissue to decay in the natural environment, you can bring that down to a day or two. Then you can start to not just use the fruiting body of the plant, you can use the entire plant. And that's what corporations are banking on. That genetically modified variations of the plant tissue and microbial adjustment could bring in a second generation of biofuel to allow the entire plant to be used and really volume up the amounts that are available in international markets. Now, this has major scare stories, I'm sure, for any of us in Europe who've already fought off GM campaigns for food. Tinkering around with plant tissue is one of them. Tinkering around with microbes is quite another. Nature's plant life has armoured itself with living and cellulose and armoured itself against decay. That's why it takes 7 years for the tree tissue or the bark and the trunk of the tree to actually break down. Introducing microbes, even artificially, to do it much more quickly. What happens if those microbes get out into natural environments? What happens if they end up in forests and suddenly you've got microbes destroying natural plant life in natural days instead of natural years? This is really scary sci-fi stuff. So we have major concerns about the level with which corporations are taking this without any kind of preliminary checks or safeguards in place. So this is the second generation, the use of plant genomes and variations on plant genomes and microbial variation. Now, we're also on to, amazingly enough, third generation, which is synthetic biology, which is where you'd actually build up the materials for the plant tissue. You could actually, to some degree, build them up artificially. In other words, you could change the DNA of the plant itself. Synthetic biology is a little bit further away, but it's still very, very present, and again, corporations are banking on this. Right. That, I think I'm going to leave it as that. How are we doing for time? Yes, I'm going to leave it at that. So, folks, we haven't got a lot of time, but shall we take a few questions? And Steve, do you want to ask? What I wanted to invite you to do is we run a campaign newsletter just about once a month, and we advertise different campaigns we're running around the country to do with biofuels. We also let people know about email campaigns that we're running against the EU and the UK government, which are part of it. So if you'd like to be part of that and find out a bit more, and we send you out an invitation to join us at campaign news probably every month or so. There's also an opportunity to join something on our website which we call Daily Digest, which is a compilation of all the biofuel and deforestation stories worldwide, particularly biofuel stories, to help you get an idea of the information. So if you'd like to be on either of those, could you just put your email address on the sheet that Steve's going to pass around? And if you'd like the daily information, just put daily in brackets. Not everybody wants that because you've probably got enough emails coming through. So I'm going to assume you want the campaign news, which comes once a month, if you fill out that. We'll just put your name as that. So folks, thank you for listening. Let's take a few questions now and just see if there's any thoughts that you have as well about my parents.
You said that Southeast Asia's peatland is almost 50 billion tons of carbon. I was just wondering, that doesn't really mean a lot to me. What does that compare to perhaps what annual fossil fuel use produces? So I suppose more broadly what I'm asking is, what is the potential for release of carbon dioxide from biofuels compared to fossil fuel use or something else?
We emit about 8 gigatons a year. A gigaton is 1,000 million tons of carbon, not carbon dioxide.
That's what human activity on the planet, that 8 gigatons a year. When we add in the deforestation, in other words, the biological carbon that enters the atmosphere, it's about 10.5 to 11 gigatons. So we're adding about two and a half to three gigatons of biological carbon on top of the fossil fuel carbon that enters the atmosphere. Does that give you a sense? So 50 gigatons of peak emissions would be, in terms of human emissions, of about 8 gigatons, what I haven't 8 and 50, six years of human emissions. The Amazon is about 120 gigatons, that's the carbon in the forest and carbon below the soil. So, again, you're talking about maybe about 15 years of anthropogenic emissions. So you lose those two ecosystems themselves, to 15 plus 8. It takes 23 years ahead if you lose. You wouldn't lose them in one go, but you could cross a tipping point where instead of linear degradation that we're seeing now, you start to see exponential shift. And that's why I say that the Amazon, we don't know. My guess would be we're fighting between whether it's going to be the Siberian permafrost or the Amazon is going to be the next tipping point for the cross. And I think if you know just that much, you realise that actually we need to be very focused on what we're campaigning on. I know groups around the country are campaigning on reducing the amount of recycling in the city, or how many bags that corporations and retailers that are using. It's all irrelevant. The only things really that are central are either of those pillars of climate change, reducing emissions, protecting ecosystems, and I would suggest that something like biofuels does both aims to disrupt the ecosystems.
Thank you.
Would the ecosystems be that? Could that be included in the carbon emissions?
Exactly. So 8 gigatons is anthropogenic fossil fuel emissions, and 2.5 to 3 gigatons is biological carbon from forests.
Okay. So that's just not included at the moment, that's just a bad measuring system.
No, it's relatively. It is included in annual assessments, yeah.
Okay, but you're saying in the set of pillars for this. Why are they
saying because both need to be retained in order to stabilise climate. If you bring the emissions down, don't do the ecosystem protection, the climate still spinning out of control. If you do with the ecosystem but don't do the emissions, the climate spinning out of control. They both need to be dealt with together.
Because of the carbon.
It's only more important because we're now Until now, the fossil fuel emissions have been the dominant reason for difference in climate change. What's happening now is they're being overtaken by the noticeable ecosystem destruction climate. So that's why the Amazon, if you even there you put that report, scientific reports will say that the Amazon could hit collapse in 2025, 2030 time. It's completely rubbish. If you look at the data on the ground, 3 years of drought, in close country, there should be no droughts. Maybe you're just talking about maybe once in a million years, it's the only time we look out. Now we're seeing the internal feedbacks right now. So the whole landscape has changed as far as ecosystem is concerned. And instead of something that's happened in several decades' time, it's now coming right forward and it's overtaken fossil fuels, you're quite right, and it's more important now than fossil fuels. We still need to radically reduce emissions. In fact, I've said at the start we need to bring emissions down by 50%. Not 3%, and certainly not by 60% by 2050. We need to bring them down by 50% now. Right now. Within the next year, we need to bring them down by 50%. The reason being, ecosystems are starting to shift from being sinks or absorbers of carbon to being sources or emitters of carbon. And the most likely way of prolonging the life of ecosystems is to reduce the excess emissions that add to the atmosphere and force ecosystems to have to take up more. So we really need to reduce. So what I don't want to give the impression of is everything is about ecosystem. We absolutely don't want to reduce that amount of ecosystems. Everybody's half blocked in this 50%. And then on top of that, not only do we need to protect existing ecosystems, but we need to regenerate the ecosystem around it. And that's why I'm quite vigorously opposed to this biomass and the energy of energy, especially in the industry. Such a plethora of different renewable, true renewable energy options. The reason being, if you use biomass to generate energy, you end up with monocultural plantations, which aren't ecosystems. They don't absorb carbon in the same way the natural ecosystem does, and you always country, and restoring rainforest in the Amazon. And the risk of going on a bit, but the logical people to do that in the Amazon are the indigenous peoples and the forest peoples who live in and around those forests, and not only in the forest well, but actually there to do the work and to safeguard, protect it from fire, to ensure the right species go to make a difference in the possible time. Not the big corporations who are trying to take large amounts of money for the privilege of doing so.
Just with respect to deforestation, wondering how important is slash and burn farming in the tropics as an agent of deforestation?
Yeah. Well, there's two slash and burns. There's the indigenous slash and burn, which is people who live within forests. They clear maybe 100 metres square and they plant a tree here or two and then they move on. Entirely sustainable because the forests are able to grow that burn very quickly. The other type of burning is agricultural burning, where they will, at the end of the season, burn large areas of land to quickly get the next crop in. Now that's a problem, because large amounts of carbon go into the atmosphere, but you also dry out the land in the process. And thirdly, those fires get out of control. Some of the fires that I showed you, on the skin. Many of those were not natural sites, many were natural. Many of those were also a result of slash and burn and also a result of deliberate forest clearance because the price of soil has gone so high. Now farmers can make two or three times what they used to make even a year ago. So slash and burn is a problem, and we've got to manage it. And even in, we're seeing evidence now of Amazonian communities actually being willing to start to change, in one instance I heard about where they introduced solar heaters, which are basically concave reflective dishes that focus a beam and basically heat things to boiling point, you can cook on it, and do require no deforestation. And these are the sorts of innovative ways in which you can actually reduce the deforestation and drying out further. Is that for now?
Can I suggest we carry on the discussion in the atrium? We are having a coffee break. Because we are running out of time. In 10 minutes we have the second session of morning talks that is starting. Thank you very much, Deepak, for this enlightening talk. Thank you for your questions, and we can carry on the discussion in the atrium.